been reviewing some of Yahweh's testimony, some Moshe's testimony on behalf of Yahweh regarding the importance of his Torah and its role in our covenant relationship with God and our subsequent salvation. The last two statements in this regard from Devarim I'd like to share with you, and then we'll return to Paul's poison pen. Now that we are better equipped to ascertain the differences between Paul's grace-based gospel of salvation and Yahweh's Torah teaching. Moshe said, I have testified repeatedly to restore and to warn you on this day with regard to the spiritual realm and with regard to the material world and about life and about death. I have freely offered on your behalf and in your presence the blessings which restore the relationship and also the curse of being abated and seen as worthless. So you should actually choose in favor of continued life and in renewal, in nourishment and growth, so that you and your offspring, your children, are restored to life, are renewed and spared. This is accomplished by choosing to genuinely love and closely associate with Yahweh, your God. By really listening to his voice and to his call, and by choosing to stay especially close to him. For indeed, he is the source of your life and of the renewal of your life and of lengthening you your days, enabling you to dwell in the realm which Yahweh promised to your fathers, to Abraham, to Yishak, and to Jacob, to give it as a gift to them. So from Yahweh's perspective, he is the source of restoration. He is the source of life. And it is by drawing close to Yahweh, coming to love Yahweh, associating with Yahweh, that life is restored and our souls are renewed. It's by our acceptance of, our reverence for, our respect towards Yahweh, that our days are elongated in the realm that he has promised to us. There's no mention here of our allegiance to the graces, to the gospels, to a church, to a New Testament, and to a God named Jesus or Jesus Christ. The means to life, to restoration, to relationship, is become by coming to know, love, revere, and respect Yahweh as he is introduced to us, and the means to engage with him is delineated in his Torah. That's it. Period. There is no other plan. There is no other testimony. There is no other testament. That's it. Yahweh's perspective, his guidance, is sufficient. It's clear. To lead those who are seeking him to know him. For those of us who wish to understand what he's offering, to appreciate the gift of the covenant. And for us to learn how to respond. So now we're in a position to determine whether or not Paul was telling the truth when he came up with his New Testament, when he called Yahweh's Torah incompetent, unable to save. We now know that this covenant was issued through Abraham, through Yishak and Jacob, and not through Sarah and Ishmael. We're now in a position to hold Paul accountable should he continue to lie. And in this light, if we're going to seriously consider the so-called Christian New Testament, It is incumbent upon us to accurately relate the words contained therein so that they can be understood correctly. If it is to be considered a godly document, we are not at liberty to change it, at least without consequence. And if it is not godly, by changing it, we obfuscate the evidence thoughtful people require to evaluate its veracity. So let's not change euangelion, which means beneficial messenger and healing message, to the religious concept of gospel. Now, having introduced his second thought with, this is now Paul from Galatians 1:6, I marvel, I'm amazed and astonished, wondering and surprised that many were quickly and in haste changed. They deserted and departed, becoming disloyal apostates and traitors from your calling in the name of grace to a different healing message and beneficial messenger. He continued with, which does not exist differently, if not perhaps. Some are the ones stirring you up, confusing you, and also wanting and proposing to change and pervert the beneficial messenger and the healing message of the Christu. Now, think of that for a moment. Paul is railing at the Galatians because they abandoned him. They became apostates. They were traitors in his view because they disassociated with grace, from grace, in his message promoting the cute little Roman and the Greek goddesses to a different healing and beneficial message, to the Bashar of Yahusha, which is the healing and beneficial message, the good news of Yahweh in his plan of restoration and redemption as it is delineated in the Torah. But now Paul is saying, oh, but you know, come on, let's all be friends, let's just all get along, so long as you agree with me that these messages really aren't different. If not, perhaps there are some stirring you up and confusing you. You know who was stirring them up and confusing them from Paul's perspective? Yosha's disciples. And also wanting and proposing to change and pervert the beneficial message and the healing message of the Christu. Yeah. The message that the disciples conveyed related to the Messiah, Yosha, and the message that Paul was relating were completely different. And so when the Galatians were confronted by both accounts, one from the disciples, the other from Paul, and they were wholly incongruent, they wisely chose to disregard Paul's view. They knew that Paul had never met with Yosha, and the others had lived with him. They knew that the disciples' presentation of the Messiah, Yosha, was consistent with the Torah, and they knew that Paul's message and caricature was wholly disassociated from the Torah. It was an easy call. Any rational person, disunited from the societal lies that are being promoted today, would make the same call. Any of you who is properly educated would make this same call. It's obvious. It was obvious to the folks back then. So that you know, this same clause was translated in the Nestle Allen, the 27th edition, McReynolds English Interlinear, as what not is other, except in brackets, not applicable. Some are the ones troubling you and wanting to turn across the good message of the Christ. I'll read that again, because this claims to be a literal translation of the oldest manuscripts. And if we're going to deal with this, we have to understand how poor the writing quality is, how inept Paul was at communicating. According to the most trusted resource Paul wrote, "What's not is other except, not applicable. Some are the ones troubling you and wanting to turn across the good message of the Christ." Utter gibberish. So since the writing quality is poor, since Paul infrequently defines his terms, since it required a considerable effort to ascertain the distinction between Paul's position and God's, I suspect that the Galatians were scratching their heads, wondering what Paulos was trying to say. Half a breath ago, he bemoaned that there were two distinctly different approaches. He was angry because so many had abandoned his mantra for the other proposition. Now he appears to be saying that these two messages aren't different at all, but that they are only being made to appear to be in discord by some unknown agitator. But how can that be? When, in his previous sentence, he had his Lord snatching us away from the old system? And in spite of this, our maestro of confusion is calling his rivals confusing. The man responsible for the great upheaval in human history said that those who had challenged his upending of God's message were guilty of perversion. It is the tactic that politicians deploy to demean their rivals today, projecting their own faults upon their opponents. So when the party who is not actually guilty of the crime responds, the audience becomes sufficiently confused to question the impropriety of the slandered, leaving the actual perpetrator of the crime unscathed, their biggest fault no longer considered. Now that's precisely what's happening here. Paul could not have been more disingenuous if he tried. Paul is accusing Yosha's disciples of being duplicitous, of perversion, when it is actually Paul who is guilty of this crime. It is the exact same ploy that almost every politician deploys today to confuse the audience, to not know who is acting wrongly. So in these words with Paul, we are also witnessing insecurity, the very trait that made him susceptible to Satan in the first place. Paul is very thin-skinned. He cannot tolerate a rival. He pounces on every opponent, every threat to his authority, real or imagined. The liar calls others perceived more worthy, liars in an attempt to cut them down so that he can rise above them. So a liar is always calling those who expose their lies liars. They always slander those who are actually telling the truth. And they do so in an attempt to destroy a rival. And it's the only way they know how to rise is to cut others down. And like most all insecure men, Paul is drawn to those who are confident, in this case, Yahusha and his disciples, in hopes of filling the enormous void in his own life, only to turn against them as a result of his own flawed and corrupt character. This is the mindset and the character of such individuals. It is a dance which has been played out thousands of times in every walk of life, but never with the stakes this high. If you have never witnessed the destructive capacity of an insecure individual, you're fortunate. And if, as a result, you don't see this character flaw driving Paul's inappropriate and angry rant against the Galatians for not believing him, then at the very least, I hope that you see his words as mean-spirited and disingenuous. This is a million, billion miles from Scripture. When this introductory statement is set into the context of Paul's life and writings as we know them, it becomes obvious that Paul's message was the only one which was completely different than everyone else's, including Yahweh's, Yahusha's, and the disciples. And considering the qualifications of the others, Charles was very hard to believe. So the purpose of this epistle was to launch a defensive campaign and a defense of his authority through a series of offensive attacks. Consistent with the idea presented in the opening chapter, Paul will continue to undermine, belittle, and besmirch the Torah, separating his caricature of Yahusha from it, so as to nullify his sacrifice. And before long, we will witness him discrediting Yahusha's disciples, effectively nullifying the Messiah's message. These things done, he substituted his own doctrine while claiming to have God's authorization to contradict God. You may be wondering why I'm so judgmental, tearing Paul to pieces for mistakes both big and small, especially since I admitted to being fooled by him for so many years. Now, the reasons are varied. As I've shared, my intent wasn't to expose and condemn the difference between Pauline doctrine and the Torah, but instead, I attempted to resolve them. I began doing what many have done before me. In fact, some have made a religion of it by blending rabbinical Judaism with Pauline doctrine. They either call themselves Messianics or Hebrew roots. But then I reached a point where I couldn't do it anymore. I could no longer find any common ground. The chasm grew too large. The conflicts became insurmountable. And the more I looked into Yahweh's testimony and Yahusha's citations of it for help, the more I found them at odds with Paul. Ultimately, I had to take sides. I could either be with God or side with Paul. And while that was an easy choice, neither Yahweh nor Yahusha are ever easy on those who corrupt their message. Their approach is now mirrored in this book, in this presentation I'm sharing with you. It is informed, rational, relentless, uncompromising, and especially judgmental. Too much is at stake to take any other approach. Also, I suppose that I'm sympathetic to those who believe, as I once did, that Paul spoke for God. I fully appreciate how enormously difficult it will be for many of you to process and accept the evidence which is being laid before you. So while I make no apologies for being judgmental, I nonetheless appreciate your situation. I appreciate that this judgmental, this uncompromising approach to Paul's letter, and the unpopular nature of a message which serves to undermine the entire credibility of the Christian New Testament, I'm going to turn a lot of people away who might otherwise have been helped if this review wasn't so one-sided. But God's one-sided. Always has been, always will be. He is uncompromising. He is condemning. And yet, ultimately, every one of us will eventually have to take sides on this argument. And I've made my choice. I'm hoping you do as well. Surprisingly, it wasn't especially hard for me to admit that I had been wrong, even that I'd been played for a fool. In fact, it was a relief, as I hope it is for everyone listening to this today. There's something wonderfully liberating and reassuring when you come to a place that everything falls into place, where there is no longer a collection of odd-shaped pegs which have to be wiggled and whittled to fit, forced into position. So the bottom line with all of this is that you shouldn't trust me any more than you trust Paul. Yahweh alone is trustworthy. Do your own research. Compare their testimony. And then decide. Now, speaking of perverting, as we have been, the King James Version, as we've been experiencing here, the King James Version changed if not to but. They added there and that without any justification. They ignored philo and its meaning entirely, as if the verb was not extant in the text. Turned around and changed was rendered pervert, and euangelion was replaced by gospel. Then they added insult to injury. The King James Version replaced the placeholder, chi rho upsilon, the divine placeholder for Messiah, with a transliteration of a derogatory Greek word, which was not actually written in the text, and then they wrote Christ. Besides all of that, they did a pretty good job with, but there be some that trouble you. There be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. Now, there is no gospel of Christ. There is no Christ, and there most certainly isn't a gospel of Christ. There is good news presented by the Messiah. There is a direct connection with the Bashar, the good news of the Torah and the words and deeds of Yahusha. But there absolutely is no gospel of Christ. The Latin Vulgate reads, "Except there are some persons who disturb you and who want to overturn the Evangelium Christi." To Jerome's credit, overturn is a literal translation of metastrepho, and euangelium is an accurate transliteration of euangelion. Now, to help us retain our footing, the text actually reads, "which does not exist differently, if not conditionally or hypothetically negated, because perhaps some are the ones stirring you up, confusing you, and also wanting and proposing to change and pervert the beneficial messenger and healing message of the Christu." But evidently, feeling at liberty to write whatever they wanted, the New Living Translation completely ignored the presence of euangelion in their rendering. They published, "You are being fooled by those who deliberately twist the truth concerning Christ." Yet that wasn't their only liberty. Tarasso doesn't mean you are being fooled. There is no basis whatsoever for by those who deliberately, or any basis for the truth concerning. And the XPY, the chi rho upsilon placeholder, is based upon Christus, not Christos. And it represents the Messiah, not Christ. But by stating that the Galatians were being fooled by those who were deliberately twisting the truth concerning Christ, the New Living Translation exonerates Shaul, Paul, while condemning Yahweh's witness. In their Bible publication, the truth had been upended. Now, as you consider the third clause of the second sentence, keep in mind that there were two messengers who came out of heaven, one trustworthy, the other deceitful. Also note the switch from Paulos as the ultimate individual to we. I suspect that this is because he wanted his audience to believe that he was now speaking in conjunction with his God. This is something I'm particularly attuned to because I've seen it in Muhammad, who also admitted being demon-possessed. He not only used we similarly throughout the Quran, He positioned himself as errantly and as egotistically. So at the very least, if you aren't yet ready to acknowledge the satanic influence, Paul is elevating himself to the place where he and his God are now speaking with the same voice. Furthermore, he is inferring that he is a messenger from heaven, while stating unequivocally that a person will be cursed if they challenge him. This is how he continues in Galatians 1:8. But to the contrary, if we or a messenger out of heaven might convey a healing message or beneficial messenger to you, which is approximate or to the contrary to what we delivered as a beneficial messenger to you, then a curse exists. Kid you not? That's exactly what he wrote. So he's talking about that other messengers from heaven. Now, he's, by the way, only a messenger from heaven, and that Satan fell from heaven. But he's saying, you know, if anybody else brings a message that is different from the one that Paul is bringing, that they should be cursed. Well, that would be Yahweh, God. That would be Yahusha, the corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. That would be the disciples. That would be all the prophets. That would be everyone who ever spoke for God, including God himself, would be those that Paul would curse because their message is counter to his. Different in every possible way. So claiming to speak for God, Paul is cursing the very message from God that contradicts his own message. It's pretty bold. But what's horrible about this is not just that he did it. It's that billions of people have been bamboozled into believing that it is possible to contradict the message of God, to curse God, and yet still speak for God. All of you who have embraced Christianity, who have promoted Christianity, shame on you. It's so obvious that he's lying. Why is it that you would surrender your soul to such a horrible man? So here we are. You know, this is Paul claiming that anyone who says anything different should be cursed. This not only screams insecurity, which incidentally manifests itself as paranoia, with everyone else seen as a lesser life form and as a potential foe, but also as delusional, with an insatiable need to be viewed as essential and right, no matter how useless and wrong the speaker may be. And this time, Paul has gone so far as to say that he and his Lord are going to curse the opposition, even if the competitor is a heavenly messenger. Well, the most famous of all heavenly messengers is Yahusha. The second most famous is the set-apart spirit. They both represent Yahweh. Now, from this point forward, we are a mere two sentences into Paul's first letter. Christians would invoke a curse on all and any who would question their faith. Any opposition to Pauline doctrine would be deemed as satanic, and yet it was Satan speaking through his apostle Paul who was cursing mankind with these words. But here, we're just in the second sentence. And Pauline Christians have been told in a passage that they have canonized, that they think is scripture, that anyone who contradicts Paul's message is going to be cursed, even if that representative comes directly out of heaven. God himself would be cursed for disagreeing with Paul's message.
It's egregious. It's ridiculous. It's pathetic. It's preposterous.
And yet there are billions of people beguiled by this fraud. Now, in reality, Yahweh himself sent a messenger out of heaven to convey his healing and beneficial message. His name explained his purpose, Yahusha, meaning Yahweh saves. His message was in perfect harmony with his Torah, making it the opposite of what's being conveyed by Paul. Therefore, a dreadful consequence does exist. Satan was also a messenger out of heaven, as are all of Yahweh's malach, to cite the Hebrew term for heavenly messenger, spiritual messenger, corrupted in Christianity to angels because the Greek word for messenger is agelos. His message even approximates Yahweh's witness, making it an effective counterfeit, something which appears genuine and yet is contrary to our interests. All of this is being presented as a counterfeit, as a bogus bill, as something that appears to be genuine, but is actually worthless. The adversary, Hasatan, used Saul. And he brought a curse upon himself and upon all who were in league with him. That's why Yahweh, and through the prophet Habakkuk, Chabauk in Hebrew, embraced this, told us that Paul would prevail and disseminating his influence over Goyim, Gentiles, but that not a single person who embraced Pauline doctrine would be satisfied. That Paul would in fact be the plague of death. Yahweh announced this sentence in the Garden of Eden, really, against the adversary 6,000 years ago, telling us that the serpent would be cursed for having beguiled Yahweh by corrupting his testimony. So the curse that the adversary brought upon himself has now found its way into Paul's preamble. By writing this, Paul's intent was to render any competitive message moot, especially Yahweh's, Yahusha's, the disciples. He wanted his audience to join him in condemning his foes, which were God and God's spokesman. This is akin to Islam, where Allah warns Muslims to be ever ready to attack, even to slander and kill, all those who would besmirch the Islamic God's reputation, especially if they're willing to tell the truth. And while Allah is Satan, the wannabe God prevails by labeling his opponent satanic and thereby confusing the feeble-minded. You know, the number of times that I was quoted as being satanic, or I was slandered as being satanic by Muslims because I dared present the five oldest Islamic sources, all in chronological order, all in conjunction with Muhammad's life, all such that they provided chronology and context for the Quran. Yes, by presenting what Muhammad said and did, I was labeled satanic. And yet, I was actually exposing Satan's guise as Allah. Well, the same thing is true with Pauline Christianity. When you expose Paul for what Paul himself admitted, for being demon-possessed, when you reveal that Paul's testimony is what Satan desires, not what God conveys, it is those very same Christians that slander the messenger and call them satanic. It is the escape mechanism that these kinds of liars deploy. And these are not just normal liars. I mean, there's lots of people who have defrauded others. But when you defraud someone, when you claim to be God's messenger, as Paul did, as Muhammad did, and where billions of souls are beguiled by your statements, that's a special form of deceit. Well, God will play no role in hell. Well, he will not torment anyone in Sheol. There is an absolute guarantee that Paul and Muhammad will spend their eternity there, along with the messenger that they represented, Satan. And I strongly suspect that it won't have to be God who torments them, because God will not be in the place of separation from him. But all of his victims, all of those Muslim jihadists, all of those Christian evangelicals, all of the Christian preachers and popes who bought into this stupid religion will constantly be accusing Paul of having misled them. It'll be hell for him. It'll be hell for Muhammad. But, you know, the likelihood is that Satan, Paul, Muhammad, will all explain to their victims that, come on, look how stupid this was. You have no one to blame but yourself. I claimed to be speaking for God, and yet I contradicted everything that God said. Why were you so easily fooled? I was obviously wrong. Both men claimed that Jesus was was one of their prophets, was essential to their doctrine, and yet both contradicted everything that Yahusha said and did. It should be obvious. So the victims of Christianity, the promoters of Christianity, really have no one to blame but themselves. And that will be the ultimate discussion of hell. Its preoccupation will be the victims of religion, those who promoted the religion, accusing the creators of that religion, whether it be Paul and Christianity, or Muhammad and Islam, of misleading them, and those founders just laughing at their faces. Don't join them.